From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, Democrats in Wisconsin say the climate is right for them to succeed in midterm elections this fall. They say they're the best party to represent a fundamental truth about Wisconsinites.
We're like a salad bowl. We're made up of all different kinds of people from different backgrounds, from different cultures, and that's what makes us rich. Everybody enjoys a salad that has a lot of different things in it.
Later, writer David McGlynn talks about getting used to being a dad and getting used to living in Wisconsin.
And Canadian fingerstyle guitarist Callum Graham describes how he plays so many parts with only two hands.
It's kind of like the guitar, I guess, with a piano. You have the right and left hand doing, you know, two different, very different parts. But how it all layers together is kind of like a human loop pedal. And it all works out.
Lake Effect comes your way right after this news from NPR. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The past few regular election cycles have been challenging ones for Democrats in Wisconsin. But following several special elections, both here and elsewhere in the country, there are indications that races in 2018 could be different.
Whether the current political climate reflects a so-called blue wave or not, Democrats in Wisconsin are hopeful about their chances to unseat Governor Scott Walker this fall and to win races all the way down the ticket from Congress to the State House.
This past weekend, the party faithful gathered in Oshkosh for the Democratic Party of Wisconsin's convention. Martha Lanning is chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party. She spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver about the issues she says voters have been most concerned about and how she believes the party is responding.
Well, they're really the pocketbook issues. They're the inability to make a living wage, that people are living paycheck to paycheck. They don't know how they're ever going to save money for retirement or college or be able to purchase a home. Healthcare is a big issue. People are concerned about access to healthcare and the cost of it. They just need it to be affordable. And so people are really concerned about their neighbors, their family, their friends, and how the top seem to continue to get richer and richer, but we end up with an economy that's only working for them, not for everybody else.
And what are some of the ways that the Democratic Party is looking to tap into voters who may be concerned about these things?
Well, we've created a great field team that is reaching out and making connections. We're going door to door. We have 140 neighborhood teams all over the state that are knocking on doors and asking voters what are the issues most important to them, what's concerning them, and then sharing with them what Democrats would do differently.
Do you feel like this is a good year for Democrats?
Absolutely. You know, with all of this concern about the economy, people are looking for answers, and we have those answers. There's better choices to be made. Scott Walker is giving a $4 billion handout to a foreign company that has a really sketchy background and not coming through on their promises, not providing good paying jobs. We could have taken those same tax dollars, spread them out all over the state of Wisconsin by investing in Wisconsin entrepreneurs, creating jobs that would stay here long term, be more reliable. So we have better options.
What about people who would say that the employment levels are very low in Wisconsin and in the country right now?
There's so many reasons for why we have a low employment rate. One, Wisconsin is labeled as one of the top 10 states to leave. If people leave, they're not looking for employment anymore in Wisconsin. Number two, people have two, three, four jobs just to survive. You know, what we want is someone to have one job so that they're making a living wage, work their 40 hours, and then can come home and enjoy life with their family, can be an active participant in their child's education and in our community.
What about areas of the state where there are high unemployment rates? Is the Democratic Party looking to focus on that as well?
Well, I think it is a big issue, is that when you go into certain areas of our state and there is high unemployment, what is Scott Walker doing to bring business to those areas? And he's not doing the right things. We need to be sure that our communities are thriving, that they can attract a workforce, but we also need to be sure that we're encouraging businesses. Maybe some of that $4 billion that was handed out to one company could be used to help people within that community create businesses that would offer gainful employment to those people.
So you've mentioned economic issues. Are there any other things that the Democratic Party would consider a Republican weak spot in these upcoming elections?
Well, it's really disturbing to Democrats the values of the Republican Party. Democratic values are Wisconsin values. We believe that all people, regardless of their race, their economic ability, where they live, should have an opportunity to succeed. We want to be sure that every child gets a good quality education in every corner of our state. And we want to stop the hate. You know, we are a country. We're like a salad bowl. We're made up of all different kinds of people from different backgrounds, from different cultures. And that's what makes us rich. Everybody enjoys a salad that has a lot of different things in it. Well, that's what Wisconsin is all about, and that's what America is about, and that's what we stand for.
Do you feel like there are going to be any particularly contested races this cycle?
Well, absolutely, Scott Walker. I mean, it's a key issue for us to replace Scott Walker. We need to be sure that Senator Tammy Baldwin is getting back into the Congress. And we know that's going to happen because Tammy works for Wisconsinites. She is with us. When she saw a greedy hedge fund come in and buy up a profitable paper company, shut it down, costing us hundreds of jobs in that community, and for the community itself to go bankrupt, she wrote legislation to be sure that greedy hedge funds can't do that in the future. You know, Tammy Baldwin is concerned about Wisconsinites and the challenges that they have, you know, going after big pharma companies that are trying to gouge our neighbors by jacking up pharmaceutical costs so much. And so we're going to work hard to be sure that Tammy gets elected.
What do you think some of the other key differences are between Tammy and Leah Vukmir?
Well, Leah Vukmir just, you know, she wants to rip away health care from people. She doesn't believe that we should be concerned about that. She's 100% behind this huge tax break, which is literally a handout to corporations who are making millions and millions of dollars and now no longer going to be paying their fair share. It's a handout to the wealthiest people in our country. And it's just not the way we do things. Everybody should pay their fair share. And when everybody is paying their fair share, and when we create an economy that works for everyone, we all do better. And when we all do better, Wisconsin will thrive.
So moving on to the race for governor, there's multiple candidates, obviously. Do you think that, voters may not have a feel of who the leading candidates are? How is the Democratic Party looking to deal with that?
Well, last night in the hall, all 10 of our candidates spoke, and people really had an opportunity to see the differences between them. I think we're going to see the candidates, you know, gaining momentum and rising up, and with more and more opportunity for them to get their message out. I think we'll all get behind that nominee that we select in August.
And what are some concrete ways that you're planning to do that?
Well, right now we have asked all of our candidates to make a commitment that they will get behind the nominee. And almost every one of them have done that. And I think that's just an example that the candidates that we have running for governor know that the main goal is to be sure that Scott Walker is not the governor in November, because Wisconsin can't afford for him to be there any longer. And when we all unite, as we have at this convention, I mean, unlike the Republican convention where there was so much disagreement and disputes. We've had just a fabulous convention here, listening to people, hearing from each other. Voters will make a decision in August, and we will be sure that in November we elect the next Democratic governor.
So 2010, Scott Walker was elected, and then there was the recall election that he survived politically, and then he was reelected. What do you think has changed since that point?
Well, one is, I think that people can see that the Republican agenda is not working. We have the second worst roads in the nation, and the cost of repairing them is climbing exponentially regularly. We just were ranked the third highest state in the nation to have people dropping out of the middle class. You know, we're dead last in entrepreneurism. The Republican agenda is not working, and people want to see change. But secondly, the Democratic Party itself, since I have come into office, we've been building an infrastructure. Structure that will let us fight against the huge money that the Republicans pour into this election. We're going door to door, and we're building that infrastructure to knock on those doors and be sure people are aware of what Democratic leadership would offer them. And when we do that well, we will win in November, and we are doing it well right now, as you can see with the win with Patty Schachner and electing the first liberal non-incumbent justice to the Supreme Court since 1995.
How do you think national politics are playing into Wisconsin politics?
Well, I think that people are tired of the president's tweets. They're concerned about the moral fabric of our our Republican Party, people are really concerned about what's happening to our democracy. You know, we were a country that is inclusive and welcoming, and instead we're attacking, you know, people. And it's just not, you know, when you're ripping children away from people who are just trying to find a better life for themselves and crossing the border, and then you can't even find the children later, that's just not who we are. Yes, national politics, all politics right now is concerning to people because it's just not working the way it needs to be. We need to bring back our Wisconsin values to our political system, and those values are democratic values.
And what about people who also say that maybe the Democratic Party is a little out of touch with people on the in the ground? What would be your response to that?
Well, I think we're addressing that issue because I would agree that I don't think we were as in touch as we needed to be. But that's why we have, you know, these 140 neighborhood teams and growing, reaching out and talking to voters. We're addressing issues that matter to them, whether it's up in Kewaunee talking about clean water because far too many households can't drink the water that's coming out of their spigot, or if we're talking about criminal justice in Milwaukee. Democrat, you know, politics is local, and we need to be sure we're talking about those issues, and we see that happening with our candidates, and our field team is helping get that message out to the voters.
Finally, Scott Walker has tweeted about a blue wave. What would be your position on that?
Well, we definitely can feel the excitement, and it's not surprising that Scott Walker can see it too. I mean, he knows that he is in big trouble. His agenda is not working. He made a lot of promises. He hasn't delivered on any of those promises. And as I said before, we have the second highest, the second worst roads in the nation, dead last in entrepreneurism. Wisconsin used to be known as having the best schools, and now our schools are underfunded. I mean, Scott Walker is not handling things the way they need to handle him, and that blue wave is coming because of his incompetence.
Thank you, Martha Landing, for speaking to WEWM.
Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Martha Landing is the chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party. She spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver at the Wisconsin Democratic Convention in Oshkosh. You can read more about it at WUWM.com.
Writer David McGlynn's first memoir was of a dark, difficult time in his life. His newest work is also a memoir, but an often funnier one, as he gets used to the realities of being a dad, and being a dad in Wisconsin in particular. We'll talk with David McGlynn when Lake Effect continues in just a moment, right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Father's Day is a couple of weeks away, and as some of us can attest, fatherhood is, at turns, challenging, rewarding, exasperating, and even a little fun. As the dad of two sons, writer David McGlynn has experienced all of these states of fatherhood.
He's grown used to being a dad at the same time that he's grown used to being in Wisconsin. McGlynn grew up in Texas before going to California for college, and he was living in Utah when he took a job teaching at Lawrence University in Appleton.
His new memoir, One Day You'll Thank Me, is a chronicle of his adjustment to parenting and to his adopted home state. It's sometimes absurd, sometimes touching, and almost always compelling. McGlynn talks about the new book tomorrow evening at Boswell Book Company, but he joined us in the studio ahead of that. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So the subtitle of this book is Lessons from an Unexpected Fatherhood. And while it sounds like the timing of becoming a dad might not have been ideal, was there ever any question about actually becoming a father for you?
You know, there really wasn't. I knew from a pretty early age. You know, that sounds a bit strange, but, you know, I knew growing up that I was going to one day have a family, right? I think that was just a part of my my way of thinking about myself. Given that my parents had divorced when I was 12, the question of what it means to have a family and the desires to be with a parent and children and whatnot were very much a part of my thinking as a teenager and as a young adult. I was not ready, though, for having kids when I had them. Both of them caught us off guard.
Well, and it's interesting because you said, you know, you knew from a fairly early age that you wanted to have a family. And that's kind of maybe an underrated part of the male growing up experience. The stereotype is that girls are thinking about this stuff far before boys
are. That's right.
Are.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I mean, for me, especially in my story, you know, having my parents split and my dad move away so quickly and so far away left me from a very early age, from the time I was 12, longing to be with my dad. And at a certain point, that just flips itself around where you think, you know, rather than longing to be with the dad, you start to think that one day I'll want to have children and this relationship will replicate itself. And, you know, the things that didn't get to happen when I was a kid will somehow be idealized by having children and being a dad. So that's how I've always kind of thought about having kids.
Is it oversimplifying things to talk about, you know, righting some wrongs or what might have in your mind have been wrongs?
Well, you know, not so much righting wrongs, but getting the chance to sort of have those experiences and have that kind of time and presence and consistency that I hadn't always gotten to have with my own dad.
Even so, you're right that you still were able to kind of maintain a pretty strong relationship as you could with your dad.
Well, that was the thing I was just going to say is that, you know, despite the distance between us, he and I have had from the very beginning a really close and intense relationship. And that was one of the best things of my growing up. You know, when we would spend time together, it was always really positive and also very intense and very connected time. I felt like I learned a lot from him, even though I had to learn those things in a compressed amount of time.
And sometimes over the phone next to a Dr. Pepper machine.
Oftentimes over the phone, you know. And in many ways, like the Dr. Pepper machine and the payphone, it's the kind of setup for the story, you know, that these lessons that I learned from my dad, I learned piecemeal. And I learned them through talking to him a few minutes at a time, a couple times a week. And so when I went to sort of think about how this book was going to get set up, I had that in the back of my mind. You know, these moments that you pay attention to yourself as a father or as a parent, and they started to seem like these sort of payphone conversations I was having with myself. And so that became the form that I used.
This is not your first memoir. Had you been kind of keeping track of life as a parent since it began?
So it's not my first memoir. It's my third book total. It's my second memoir. The previous memoir is A Door in the Ocean, and it came out in 2012. And that is in some ways a strange predecessor to this one because the story that one tells is far darker, and it's concerned with the loss of a close friend when I was in high school. When that book finished and I was coming out of it and looking for a new project, I started to think about, okay, what things are available to me right around my everyday and what things might be a break from this really heavy and violent story. And that was when I realized that I had these moments that I could draw out of fatherhood. And I really just started with one, and that one was the chapter in the book that's now called Heirlooms. It was published in Men's Health magazine under the title My Dad, Bad Santa. And it's about my father's really bad Christmas presents. You know, and if you can indulge it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you need to paint a picture of what some of these gifts are.
And, you know, people talk about their parents like not being good gift givers. You know, mine was bad in a whole other way, you know. For example, we would get every year like a sleeve of spaghetti and a jar of tomato sauce, or I'd get a cheese sampler. And one year he gave me a big sausage. I was always getting food. You know, I think that he and my stepmom were always sort of aghast at how much I was eating.
Change from his ashtray.
Well, and the worst that it ever was he dumped his pickup truck's ashtray into a Ziploc baggie and wrapped it up and put it under the tree. And it was $17 and some number of cents that I unwrapped, you know, sitting by the tree with a cup of coffee on Saturday morning. And the funny thing about those presents is that they were always a kind of gag between us. And at the same time, there was always something kind of emotional about them. You know, I always thought, oh, no, Christmas is going to really be a disappointment. However, the real thing with Christmas was that I didn't really want the presents in the first place. I just wanted more time. I just wanted to spend time with him, time by the ocean, which is where he lived, time just sort of hanging around. And in some ways, those presents seemed to understand that and kind of make fun of it all at the same time. And it struck me as I was sort of telling this funny story, which I just imagined as something funny, that the gift of time and presence is something I still long for with him, but it's also the thing that I can give to my own children, not only every Christmas, but in many ways every day.
It's funny because it seems like one of those cliches that you always read about that, you know, the best gift that you can give your kids is time and presence. And in the case of this cliche, it really is true.
You know, it's as much as it is a cliche, it seems as though there's really no way around it, you know. The things that we get for birthdays and Christmases and big holidays and whatever are ultimately just material things that pass away. I think the same could probably be said with the ways in which we approach parenting in terms of thinking about advice that we dispense. You know, here's the thing you need to know about this. Here's the thing you need to know about that. Here's how you tie a tie, and here's how you start the lawnmower, and here's how you, you know, ask someone out on a date or something like that. What really ends up mattering, I think, is just that we're around each other. We spend time in each other's presence. We create spaces as parents and children, as fathers to sons, to have intimate and honest conversations. And so presence ultimately is the best possible present.
Let's get back for a second to that word unexpected.
Yeah.
What do you see as maybe the most unexpected or among the most unexpected aspects to fatherhood as you've experienced it?
That's a really great question. You know, I guess I would say I've always imagined myself as a kind of person of principle. You know, I think a lot. I think through my writing. I'd always thought that when I, you know, became a father, I would have these commitments and these ideals that I would somehow try to live by. And here are the things that I'm really connected to, you know, as a family, as a person, as a parent, as a whatever. And children seem like they are born knowing how to thwart your principles, your ideals, and your best intentions. They are endlessly moving targets. And that means that in most situations, and in many ways the book is sort of telling these stories again and again, we're presented with some kind of challenge. I think that I have a principle that's going to lead me through, and it never quite goes the right way the first time around. And I find myself having to back up, rethink it, and sort of, you know, change course in response to how the kids are trying to thwart my own expectations or my own good efforts or sort of get around whatever, you know, thing I've sort of put before them.
We should note that there is, in fact, a kid in the studio with us.
He's sitting right here beside me.
And he has not thwarted any part of this interview yet.
He's inching ever closer, though. He's about to speak into the microphone.
So I wonder if you have any concerns that a book like this puts your readers in the position of judging your parenting skills and your wife's parenting skills.
Yeah. You know, I don't think I have real concerns about how they're going to judge us. You know, one of the ways that a book like this works is that you just throw yourself out there and say, you know, and this is in some ways the conceit, you know, for everything that I was confronted with, I screwed it up the first time. And it turned out to be okay. By seeing the failure the first time around, I'm able to go back and learn it in a different way. And I'm sure that there are things that I do as a dad, whether intentionally or inadvertently, that people are going to really disagree with. And that's okay. You know, I think that it's more important to understand that most of us are trying to make it up as we go along. And there's probably the most joy and the most unexpected delight, as well as the unexpected moments of meaning and closeness and intimacy that happen when you have to improvise, you know. And I would guess that most parents are great improvisers.
Yeah, I try not to invoke books by other authors during interviews with authors, but there's a book just coming out by the writer Pamela Druckerman that is sitting on my to-be-read stack next to my bed, but it's called There Are No Grown-Ups. And I think part of the point it makes is that for most of us, adulthood is this kind of learn-as-you-go proposition.
Yeah. You know, I don't know that book, but I do think that that's a very true statement. You know, most of us are trying to do the best that we can. One of the things that interested me as I was sort of working on One Day You'll Thank Me is the way that American men or American fathers get portrayed in pop culture and in the media, you know, and if you think about it, especially think about the TV shows that feature dads as a sort of prominent part of the show, you often have the sort of heavy-handed, heavy-fisted, dictatorial father. And on the other hand, you have the sort of Phil Dunphy character. And I'm a great fan of Modern Family, but he in some ways is emblematic of that other side. You know, he's the constant playmate. He's kind of adult. You know, he's often sort of cruising for a kind of comeuppance or something, you know. And my experience talking to friends, talking to people, you know, sort of just in the course of life, tells me that most American fathers of whatever persuasion are somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. You know, few of any of us see ourselves as absolute sort of heavy-fisted dictators. And yet most of us see ourselves as taking the job seriously. You want to do right by your kids. And that means that, you know, when confronted with challenges, problems, whether they're funny or they become more serious, you don't want to just sort of wave it off or dismiss it. You don't want to overreact and you don't want to underreact. You're looking for that sort of Goldilocks happy medium. And I was trying to show that the mistakes lead you to that kind of you know, backwards wisdom, I guess.
It is a model of fatherhood that doesn't lend itself very well to the Father's Day cards you see at Walgreens.
Absolutely not. Yeah, absolutely not. And I didn't want it to be any kind of self-help book. You know, the other thing that you see with Father's Day books or father's books are survival guides, you know, the sort of sergeant's guide to surviving the first year of fatherhood or something. And again, I think that most parents don't just want to survive it. They want to thrive. They want to have a relationship with their children that is meaningful and rich and fun and funny and also sort of shows them the world for all of its complex beauty.
There is one other aspect of this book that I think will resonate especially strongly with your readers here, and that's beyond just the experiencing fatherhood through new eyes. You're also experiencing Wisconsin through new
eyes.
That's
right. Yeah, that's right.
Can you talk about some of those adjustments?
I can. Yeah, and that's actually, you know, one of the sort of delights of the story for me. We came here in 2006 from Salt Lake City. I'd been teaching at the University of Utah. And we were 1,500 miles from our nearest family member. So we didn't know a soul. And we were, you know, 3 days' drive away from anybody that was connected to us. And our older son was just 2, and we were pregnant with our younger son. So we very much felt like we were an island unto ourselves. And when you're in that situation, you tend to pay really close attention to everything that's going on around you. So the first time I witnessed Appleton kind of shut down for a Packers game, which is not something I had ever seen before in my life, I was really struck by the intensity of Packer fever, you know, or going apple picking or a fish fry, you know. And one of the stories that I really loved, because it just happened so much this way, is when we went down to the Dickens Festival in Ripon, which is about an hour south of us, and we're sort of befuddled by the things that we found, including this really great display of Advent. What are they called? Nativity scenes.
Right, right.
Yeah, nativity scenes with these really hilarious but very local captions, you know. And that's not something that you see in the places where I had grown up. You know, Houston, Texas and Orange County, California are places where people have moved to and move away from because of the jobs. You know, you don't have these sort of long-standing, and you do in some small pockets, but you don't quite have.
It's a different institutional memory.
It's a very different kind of community memory. And seeing that in a place like Ripon, I found both strange, you know, and bizarre, but also really wonderful, you know. And I was just telling some friends yesterday that as time has gone on, I find myself longing for Wisconsin when I'm away from it. You know, the trees, the smell of the air, the Lake Michigan shoreline. It's amazing how a place becomes a part of you. And I think it became a part of me because, you know, my children have grown up here, and it's become so much a part of the sort of newness that I have felt in so much of my other life. The landscape is a part of it.
Which might be another unexpected aspect to
it. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and since I teach at, you know, a college, that means I'm constantly in conversation with young people who are on the verge of finishing a degree and going out to start a life. And they're always thinking about where they're going to do it. And because classes just ended, we were just having this conversation. And so-and-so wants to go to New York, and so-and-so wants to go to Chicago, and someone else wants to go overseas. And I've told them, you know, you never know how a place is going to get under your skin. And in many ways, you can't predict it. And that's exactly what happened to me. You know, I never would have guessed that Wisconsin would be a place that would get so under my skin. But by Lord, it really has.
Well, David McGlynn, thank you so much.
What
a great book and a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here.
David McGlynn's new memoir is called One Day You'll Thank Me. McGlynn, who's an associate professor and chair of the English department at Lawrence University in Appleton, is also the author of the previous memoir, A Door in the Ocean.
He'll talk about fatherhood and about his writing at Boswell Book Company tomorrow night in conversation with another Lake Effect regular, Milwaukee writer Liam Callanan.
We'll take one last break and then have an in-studio performance from acclaimed Canadian guitarist Callum Graham. Lake Effect continues with that on Milwaukee's NPR right after this. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. He is only 26, but Canadian fingerstyle guitarist and singer-songwriter Callum Graham has already performed at the Olympic Games in Vancouver and London, has released 5 acclaimed albums, and won some major Canadian music competition.
Graham was recently named one of the top 30 guitarists under 30 by Acoustic Guitar magazine. He was in Milwaukee in April to perform at UWM in conjunction with a renowned fingerstyle guitar program here. He stopped by the studio first and began with this tune called Three-Way Street. Street, Callum Graham in Lake Effect's performance studio. Welcome. My goodness, that was lovely.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
I guess I want to start. I always never quite know where I want to go because there's a part of me that wants to know more about the technical stuff. And then there's a part of me that just wants to know where the inspiration for playing this way came from. So maybe we should start there. You started playing very young.
I started when I was 13. So right around that time, I discovered Don Ross. Canadian musician, and this is actually his guitar. And Don really showed me the groove and how, you know, throughout all his songs, it's so important that, the groove is always there. And especially as a solo instrumentalist, you know, you've got to keep the time. And so that was actually a song that we did on the duet album we recorded, 1234. And that was kind of inspired by Don just keeping that backbeat. Thank you. And then the melody is very simple on top. So the two layers, it's kind of like the guitar, I guess, with a piano. You have the right and left hand doing, you know, two different, very different parts. But how it all layers together is kind of like a human loop pedal. And it all works out.
I love that, human loop pedal. And there is something mesmerizing about watching you perform that, because we see, and when people see you in concert, they'll see the same thing. You know, you're all over the instrument, and somehow all of that polyrhythm stuff is happening, and the groove is happening, the melody is happening, the harmonies are going on, and somehow it all happens with two hands.
Mm-hmm. Miraculously.
It is pretty, yeah. So Don Ross, big inspiration, and I can understand why. Brilliant, brilliant musician. When did you decide this is what I want to do all the time?
I think after I heard his first album, Bering Strait. At the time I was in high school and listening to like punk rock and metal, you know, angst phase. And then one day my guitar teacher was playing this cassette by Don Ross, and the song First Ride came on. I'm like, wow, that's cool. It's like three guitars playing. He's like, no, that's one guy. And my head exploded at that moment, and I thought, that's what I want to be doing. So I put down the electric guitar and just been playing the acoustic since.
When you are working out a song, how are you working out those parts? You know, what's the process for you? Do you work out each one individually and then kind of layer them, or are you kind of working on them concurrently?
It's different for everyone. It's kind of, songwriting is kind of like a puzzle, you know, and you get some pieces that fit together here. Sometimes you make the border first, then fill it in. Every song is kind of a different puzzle challenge, if you will. You know, it all is put together differently every time. For me, the most important thing, though, throughout all of it, aside from technical, whatever you're doing, is the melody, and that, you know, what I'm playing on the guitar transcends the guitar. So it's not just, you know, a song on the guitar. It's music that you could, you know, you could hum the melody and you could play it on a different instrument. So I try and not think with the guitar so much and think more in a musical term, with the melody kind of dictating most of the decisions in my writing.
Then what you're essentially doing after that is arranging it.
Yeah, pretty much so.
That's
yeah,
really cool.
And storytelling part of it, you know, the beginning and middle and end, all that.
And you mentioned storytelling, and that's such an interesting thing, because I think most modern fingerstyle guitarists have that in common. Most people are trying to tell a story through what they're doing, mostly without words. You mm-hmm. know, you don't have lyrics most of the time. And with these layers of sound and layers of rhythm, there's usually some sort of through line that's going on. For you, when you're writing or when something comes to you, is it like an idea about a feeling, again, depending on the song?
Usually, feeling and emotion will start something, and that will kind of lead me to other ideas and say, oh, okay, this could segue here, go into that. And then, yeah, through repetition and then, okay, need a new section, come back to it. So, yeah, it's all very interesting how it goes together. It's just a giant mess, to be honest. The creative process is a mess, and it's, you know, how do the puzzle pieces fit together? But ultimately, if you're patient with it and determined, can get some pretty cool results.
And be a good editor, too.
Yes, that's a big part, too.
They say in journalism, kill your puppies. It's like you love it, you love it, you love it, but it doesn't fit.
Yeah.
And you have to be willing to say, it doesn't work in this story, it doesn't work in this song.
Big time. And I learned that when I was co-scoring. I had the opportunity to have my music co-scored in a IMAX film on humpback whales. And that was a big part of the process, was that we wrote so much music, and then, you know, the directors would be like, no, it's not what we're looking for. Go back to the drawing board and write a whole bunch more. And then, like you said, kill your puppies. So.
Did you save any of the stuff that they rejected for the film?
Yes, actually. I wrote one piece I can play on the harp guitar and have this really beautiful theme for a visual that we were really trying to get. And I felt like it fit well, and they're like, yeah, it's just not what we're looking for. So I kind of scrapped the song and came back to it, found it a couple years later. And I'm like, hey, that's actually pretty good. I should finish that. So
can we hear the one that on the harp guitar that you wrote for the film that they didn't take?
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you so much. That was Farewell on the Most Beautiful Harp Guitar I think I've ever seen. That is just a gorgeous instrument.
Right.
I have to ask how the bass strings are tuned, the harp strings.
Well, this is actually tuned way down to a D and just goes up kind of a minor scale from there. D, E, it changes sometimes major, minor, And I have these little sharpening levers, kind of like you can do the Jaws theme. And you can do really quick tuning changes. And but
does that
yeah,
take
it's
it up a tone, a half tone or a tone?
Yeah,
or?
Semitone.
Semitone, okay.
So it's usually just I keep it in kind of a minor scale, major scale, depending on the song.
Is there a standard tuning for a harp guitar, or is it pretty much player's choice?
I guess, like, Stephen Bennett is one of the, you know, most well-known, well-recognized players, and he's kind of got a Stephen Bennett standard harp guitar tuning. But it's way up. I think his starts at an E, if I'm not mistaken. But, yeah, this is pretty low. When I told the luthier I wanted to go down to a D, are you sure? It's a lot of
is it harder to keep
attention.
It? Yeah, is it harder to keep it in tune with it?
Yeah,
taken
well,
down that?
It's a the string here is about a 90 gauge, which is like
yeah, it's huge,
it's massive. It's
it almost looks like a cello string.
Yeah, it pretty much is. And yeah, if it's tuned any lower, it just turns into a bunch of spaghetti. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely beautiful sound. Now, coming from a standard six string, and I know guitarists do all kinds of tunings depending on the song that they're playing, open tunings or partially open tunings. When you add these other six strings, it's not a standard 12-string guitar. You've got something very different going on because you're not fretting them. Was there a learning curve for you to like feel that you had any competency on this, or was it pretty quick?
Yeah, it took me a little while to, I mean, for one, looking down and usually seeing six and seeing 12 is kind of like, whoa. Whereas the, you know, it's very unfamiliar at first. But, I mean, it's, the way I think of it now is kind of like you have your regular acoustic guitar on the bottom. And then if you memorize the strings that you have it tuned to, as you said, there's no frets. So if you can memorize, you know, the different chords, like you've got a D, so you can play that, an E, F sharp. Come to an A, and then this one goes to a B. So if you can memorize that, then it kind of gives you a little bit of a map around it. But yeah.
Well, and just that progression alone was very beautiful.
Yeah,
just going right down the strings. Mm-hmm. It's like I could hear all kinds of melodies against that.
Oh yeah,
that basic movement. And, so I know in your solo performances you do more standard guitar, and you're doing harp guitar stuff as well. Have you composed on this yet?
I have. That was actually one of my songs.
That was the first
yep.
one you composed on,
yep.
or one of the first?
Farewell, that's right. Yeah, I've written a couple songs for it and worked a little arrangement of a Michael Jackson tune. That was kind of the first one that came to mind when I got this guitar. It's like, okay, now what the heck am I going to play on it? And there was a MJ song on the radio, and I thought, I wonder if I can figure that out. Do the bass part with the harp, and then the guitar part here, and sing, doing the moonwalk at the same time, and wear a white glove. You know?
On which hand, though?
Yeah.
And I know that's the one we're going to go out with. But before we do, before we hear the whole thing, how did you figure out what to do with the bass? And we're talking about Billie Jean. The song is Billie Jean. A lot of people have covered it. And so what were you trying to achieve by putting it onto this instrument?
Well, like you said, I guess you've had another guitarist, Gareth Pearson, in here who does it all on the acoustic, and it very much works on just the one. But I just thought utilizing – I haven't seen a lot of harp guitar players that really utilize the harp strings kind of like Hedges did, Michael Hedges, where, you know, he would kind of use it as these melody lines. And more than just like I was showing you there with an open string. Rather than just having that nice bass kind of resonate while you play, to have an active part that's, you know, like the bass line in that song. So it took me a little while, and the tuning on it is really weird, but it works out so that I'm able to somehow do the bass line with my right hand and keep the rest of the song going with the left. So, yeah, it took a long time to get it down.
Well, we are going to hear it. But before we do, I want to say to Callum Graham, thank you so much for coming in, playing for us. It's such a pleasure to have you in Milwaukee.
Hey, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Bonnie.
¶¶ more like a beauty queen from a movie scene. I said, don't mind, but what do you mean? I am the one who will dance in the round. She said, I am the one who will dance in the round. She told me her name was Billie Jean. She caused the scene. Then every head turned with eyes of dreaming. In the one who will dance in the round. People always told me to be careful what you do. Don't go around breaking young girls' hearts. Mother always told me to be careful who you love. Be careful what you do, 'cause a lie becomes the truth. Billie Jean is not my lover. No, she's just the guy who claims that I am the one, but that kid is not my son. She said, I am the one, that kid is not my son.
Guitarist Callum Graham performed in April as part of UWM's MKE Unplugged series, and our interview first aired then. You can read more about Callum Graham and hear all three songs he performed in the Lake Effect Performance Studio at WUWM.com. Our in-studio performance was engineered by Jason Reavy. That is all for Tuesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Don't forget, you can be in touch with us several ways. We're on Facebook and Twitter, or you can send us an old-fashioned email at lakeeffect@uwm.edu. Send us ideas for future interviews and let us know how we're doing, or just say hello.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, as always, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.
Be careful what you do, 'cause a lie becomes the truth. Billie Jean is not my life. No, she's just the guy who claims that I am the one. That kid is not my son. Nope. She said, I am the one. That kid is not my son.